Of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. I want to start again with a story, personal story, although not from my own life, but this time from my father's life. From when he was a child, from when he was a young boy, about the age of 10, maybe 12. And probably most of you don't know, but my father, in fact, was not raised Catholic. He grew up in a devout Baptist home. Now, to say that he grew up in a devout Baptist home is to say something good, right? It's a good thing, okay? It's a good thing. He grew up in a very good Baptist home. He grew up out there in Baker, Montana, and it wasn't until he met my mom and had been married to her for about 20 years, when I was in my senior year of high school, that he converted and became Catholic. Now, in fact, he had never even been baptized. So when he became Catholic when I was a senior, he was baptized at the Easter Vigil and confirmed and received First Holy Communion. And actually, I was even able to be my father's godfather. You know, canon law says that a parent can't be the godfather to a child, but in the current code, there's nothing against the son being the godfather to his father. And so I was very delighted to be able to serve in that capacity, to be my father's godfather. Now, this story comes from when my father was out there in Baker, as I say, about 10 or 12 years old, and going to the Baptist church out there, even before he had been baptized, even in these years when he was not baptized. But as I say, raised in a devout, good Baptist home. Now, in that particular community, and some of you might be familiar with this, in that particular Baptist community, on a sort of irregular basis, maybe like on the if a month had a fifth Sunday or something like this, so a handful of times a year, they would celebrate a sort of communion ritual. And now they don't believe in the Eucharist the way that Catholics do. For them, though, it is a symbol, and it is important. And the way in which this communion ritual was celebrated made a deep impression upon my father, even at that young age. He tells me how he recalls, when he was a young man, seeing the minister, the Baptist minister, bring out the communion bread, which it's not like our communion host, they're little cubes that they would use there, these little cubes of bread. They'd bring out that communion bread on a very, very fancy silver tray. Very fancy silver tray with lots of designs on it, okay? This beautiful, ornate silver tray that they'd bring out the communion bread on. And my father was also quite impressed with the reverence that the minister had as he spoke about what they were going to do in this reenactment of the Last Supper. And so then my father watched the other members of the congregation go and take the bread, and he saw they held it like this, with one hand underneath, and just to make sure that not a single crumb would fall. They were just very, very careful. Even though it was just bread to them, you know, they don't believe that it's the Eucharist. They just think it's bread, but it's a symbol to them, and so it's very important. And he was quite impressed by the reverence and care that everyone had in this ritual communion rite. Well then, so my father also got a piece of the bread, and he tells me, he remembers then looking at this piece of bread and holding it in his hand in this manner, very careful, very, very reverent manner. And he looked at that bread and he thought to himself, Jesus is in this bread. He didn't understand how, but it just seemed to him from the words of the gospel, this is my body. My father, at the age of 10, said, Jesus is in this bread. Somehow Jesus is in this bread. And when I eat this bread, then Jesus will be in me. He's in the bread, and when I eat the bread, then he'll be in me. Okay, a 10-year-old, non-baptized boy in a Protestant church, looking at a piece of bread, during a Baptist communion ritual, said to himself, Jesus is in the bread, and when I eat this bread, Jesus will be in me. Now, I know we're not to the dogma of transubstantiation. Okay, we're not there yet. But I don't think any of you will be terribly surprised to learn that many, many years later, after my father had been married to my mom for about 20 years, when Father Steve Tokarski, a priest of our diocese, whom many of you probably know, he was my dearest friend, he was the priest in St. Pius in Billings when I was growing up, Father Steve gave a homily about the Eucharist, and you won't be that surprised to hear that something in that homily struck a chord with my father, and he remembered that moment as a boy, thinking about Jesus in the bread and eating the bread and Jesus coming into him. And he left Mass that Sunday, he turned to my mom, he said, Meg, I want to be Catholic. I want to become Catholic. Now, my mom managed not to just jump up and down right there, but she was, as you imagine, quite excited. And it was the Eucharist that got him. It was for the Eucharist that he converted, and he realized that ever since that young age, he had had this longing for the Eucharist, a Protestant communion ritual, made him have this longing for the Holy Eucharist, and he finally found it in the Catholic Church. What I want to propose today in this sermon is something a little bit unusual. I'm going to propose to you that the Protestants aren't wrong about everything, okay? They're not wrong about everything, and in fact, I'm going to go further and say, I think there's a lot that we can learn from Protestants. We Catholics can learn a lot from Protestants. And yet, even another step further, I want to argue that we can learn a lot from the Protestants, even in the matter of Holy Communion. Even when it comes to the Blessed Sacrament, to the Mass, we have a lot to learn from many Protestants. I know it seems strange, and you're thinking, has Father Ryan lost it? You know, what's going on here? And if you want to write the bishop, feel free. Go ahead, write the bishop. Tell the bishop that I'm saying we need to be more like Protestants. He'll be relieved. He'll say, oh boy, finally a little change, something different, a different letter from the usual. You know, he'll probably get a good chuckle out of that. He hasn't heard that one yet. So, the point is, I'm going to argue that we have a lot to learn from the Protestants, even when it comes to the manner in which we celebrate Mass and receive Holy Communion. So let's go back to my father's example as a boy, just to take that one as an example. So as I say, it left a deep impression, this communion ritual left a deep impression upon my dad, and really did lay the foundation for him eventually becoming Catholic. And he had a real longing for Christ, and he may have made a spiritual communion of sorts. He may have even made a sort of spiritual communion that day. I will leave that up to God to decide, but it's certainly possible. But I wanna ask you, would that ritual have had the same impression upon my dad if the minister had brought out the bread not on a really ornate, beautiful, fancy silver tray, but instead, if he had just brought it out in a big glass bowl, or a big clay or pottery bowl? If he had done that, just brought out all that bread in a big glass or clay bowl, would it have had the same impression upon my father? I don't think so. It wouldn't have seemed very important. It's just in glass or just in clay. It's not a beautiful, ornate bowl made out of, or a tray made out of precious metal. It's just glass or clay. It wouldn't have had the same impression. What about this? What about if the minister had brought it out in that big glass bowl, a big pottery bowl, and then began separating the bread, just taking a handful at a time, and sort of carelessly, handful at a time, moving the bread from one bowl into that big bowl into a bunch of smaller clay bowls or smaller bowls. And if he was just doing this sort of in a hurried, rushed manner so that some of the bread is falling onto the table and some of the bread's even falling on the ground and crumbs are getting everywhere and he's just not caring about the crumbs, if that Protestant minister had done that with the bread, just moved it handfuls at a time carelessly so that the bread was falling all over the place, would it have had the same impression on my dad? Would it have seemed important to him? No, it wouldn't have seemed important. It wouldn't have seemed important. And yet I tell you, that Baptist minister in Baker, Montana, treats bread with greater reverence and greater care than some Catholic priests treat the Eucharist. That Protestant minister treats bread with greater love and reverence and care than some Catholic priests treat the Eucharist. This is why the U.S. bishops say no more glass, no more clay. You have to use precious metal. This is why our bishop says you have to use precious metal. Because it's Jesus. It's real. This is important. Even that Protestant minister used a precious metal. And guess what? The Baptists in that congregation didn't complain. They didn't say, oh, that precious metal costs too much. Oh, we like the glass. They didn't complain. The Baptists, even the Baptists know, for bread, which is just a symbol. The Protestants treat the symbol, the bread, just ordinary bread, with greater reverence than many Catholics treat the Eucharist. Because they're fine. In fact, they insist on using precious metal. They don't want glass and clay. And the Protestant ministers don't take the bread handfuls at a time, moving it from one big bowl to a bunch of smaller bowls. And yet some priests, they have less reverence for the Eucharist than a Protestant minister has for bread. And some Catholic faithful have less love for the Eucharist than some Protestants have for mere bread. Well, I don't need to use my dad as the only example. Here's another case. You go around. Look at different Protestant churches, especially Lutheran, Episcopalian, and Anglican churches. You go around and start looking at Lutheran, Episcopalian, and Anglican churches, and you might be a bit surprised to notice that in quite a number, not all, but in quite a number of even Lutheran and Episcopalian and Anglican churches, up at the front, near what we would call the sanctuary, up at the front of their churches, they have an object right here, right along the front. And that object is an altar rail. An altar rail. In Protestant churches, Lutherans, Episcopalians, Anglicans, and some others too. Not all of them, of course. Not all the Lutheran churches, not all the Episcopal or Anglican churches. But in quite a number, you'll see an altar rail. And some of them even use it. They even use the altar rail for bread. They're just giving out bread. That's all they even claim it to be. They don't even claim it to be the Eucharist. And yet, they kneel at the altar rail to receive bread. And nobody complains in the Lutheran church or in the Anglican church. Nobody complains when they kneel at the altar rail. Nobody says, oh, pastor, you're trying to drag us back to the 1950s. Nobody says that. Because it's important to them. It's important to them to show reverence. And yet you can scarcely find a Catholic church. You can scarcely find a Catholic church with an altar rail. Hardly ever will you find a Catholic church where the people are encouraged or even simply permitted to kneel to receive communion. The Protestants, some of them at least, are fine with kneeling to receive bread. But in the Catholic Church, you can scarcely find anyone who kneels to receive Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. They treat bread with greater reverence than many of us treat the Holy Eucharist. I want to tell you a story, a true story. Some of my friends, I have some friends who are Episcopalian, but eventually converted and became Catholic. Now, for years as Episcopalians, they knelt at an altar rail and received bread, communion bread. They knelt and they received communion bread. Now, actually, they received that communion bread on the hand, but they knelt at the rail and received that communion bread on the hand. They had never stood to receive communion bread until they became Catholic. The first time they ever stood for communion was when they received their first Holy Communion, when it was the real thing, the first time it was the real thing, when they received their first Holy Communion, when they became Catholic. And then they were instructed that Catholics aren't allowed to kneel. They were told Catholics stand. As Protestants, for years, they knelt to receive bread. But now that they believe it's Jesus and really are receiving Jesus, now they're supposed to stand. Doesn't that seem strange to you? Isn't that strange that as Protestants it was fine to kneel for bread, but as Catholics they had to stand for Jesus? Doesn't it seem strange? Well, it seems strange to me. It seems very strange to them. Maybe it seems strange to some of you. Now, I want to be clear here. I'm not saying that anyone needs to kneel to receive communion. I'm not saying that any particular Catholic church should have an altar rail, or even that this church should have an altar rail. I'm not saying that. I'm not making any comment about what's right or wrong. I'm only pointing out it's strange that many Protestant communities are fine using precious metal. Those ministers are very careful in the way they handle the bread, and the lay people come up and kneel at an altar rail to receive the communion bread. And yet, you see the opposite in many Catholic churches. And as I say, you can scarcely find a Catholic church. You can scarcely find a Catholic church where people are encouraged or even permitted to kneel for communion, for Jesus in Holy Communion. Well, at our church, from now on, we're going to have kneelers for Holy Communion. And you don't have to use them. No one has to use them. In the Catholic Church, you're permitted in the United States either to kneel or to stand when you receive communion. You're allowed to either kneel or to stand. Furthermore, you can, in the United States, the bishops have given permission to receive communion on the hand. So you can either receive communion on the hand or directly on the tongue. So in the U.S., to be clear, you can kneel and receive on the tongue, or you can kneel and receive on the hand. You can stand and receive on the tongue, or you can stand and receive on the hand. And of course, for many people, it's difficult to kneel. And so in order to give that option, to provide for all the options that the church allows, to be as tolerant as the church is, you know, to allow for the diversity that the church encourages, we're going to have a railing here, so that people are able, or a kneeler, so that people can kneel to receive Holy Communion. But as I say, you're welcome to stand, either behind or on either side. We're just giving the options, that's all. Just giving the options. Now, Pope Benedict stated in an interview, just before he became Pope, he stated that whether or not someone kneels or stands for Holy Communion, it's important that the attitude of kneeling remain. We have to have the interior spirit of kneeling when we come to communion. So what does that mean? What is that spirit of kneeling all about? And why is it that anyone might want to kneel to receive communion? I don't feel like I have to explain why people would want to stand, because 98% of people actually do stand. So I don't feel any need to explain that one, since that's what almost everyone does. So it should be pretty obvious, given that everyone's already doing it. I assume people know what they're doing. But why would anyone want to kneel, since that's quite a bit less common? Be good to explain why someone might want to kneel. And what is this spirit of kneeling, or this attitude of kneeling, of which Pope Benedict speaks? Kneeling signifies prayer. Okay, kneeling is an attitude of prayer. Well, Father, are you saying that standing isn't prayer? No, of course standing can be prayer. I stand to pray a lot. In fact, especially if I'm tired, I find it's a lot better if I stand when I'm praying. Once you get good at kneeling, you can actually fall asleep at the kneeler, wake up an hour or two later, oh, it hurts. Your knees get so sore, you know? So if you're tired, I recommend standing. If you're tired when you're doing your holy hour, you should stand. It's way better to stand when you're really, really tired. Far better. Nevertheless, even though it's perfectly fine to stand when we say our prayers, and I myself do it often, the fact is that in our culture today, kneeling is recognized as a posture for prayer. It's the external sign for prayer. I'm just going to use one example to prove this point. If I'm going through a really hard time in my life, struggling a lot, and I say to you, oh yeah, things have been really hard. Things have been really hard lately. I'm spending a lot of time on my feet. What does it mean? If I say things are hard, I'm spending a lot of time on my feet lately, it means I've been working really hard. I've been running around a lot. But if I want to say I've been praying, I say I've been spending a lot of time on my knees. Right? That's what I say. I've been spending a lot of time on my knees. And everyone knows what I mean. None of you would be confused to hear me say that. Things have been hard. I've been spending a lot of time on my knees lately. You all know what I mean. I mean, I've been praying a lot. Because kneeling is the sign of prayer. Kneeling is the attitude of prayer. And when we come to receive communion, we want to have that attitude of prayer. That's why Pope Benedict said we have to have the interior spirit of kneeling, the interior attitude of kneeling, when we receive Holy Communion. Because it's that prayerful attitude, that prayerful spirit. So then you need to ask yourself, what most helps me, what helps me the best to have that interior spirit of kneeling, that interior spirit of prayer? What helps me the most? Standing or kneeling? So if for you, the best way to have the interior spirit of kneeling is to actually stand, then you should stand. But if for you, as it has been for most Catholics throughout the history of the Church, the best way to have the interior attitude of kneeling is to kneel, then you should kneel. Okay? That's how it goes. Whatever is going to help you have that interior spirit of kneeling. So if the way to kneel in your heart is for you to stand, then you should stand. But if, like most Catholics throughout the history of the Church, the way to have the interior spirit of kneeling or to kneel in your heart is for you to actually kneel, then we have the kneeler here for you to make use of. And you're totally free to do it either way. Either way is perfectly permissible. One is not better than the other. No one way is better than the other. They're both entirely fine, both good. It's about what helps us in our heart the most. What helps us to kneel in our heart the most. Okay, the second thing about kneeling, first was that it's a sign of prayer. The second thing about kneeling is that it's a sign of reverence and humility before the majesty of God. Right? When we would go before a king, you wouldn't stand in the Middle Ages. You would genuflect. You'd put a knee to the ground. And even today, when we come into the church, if the tabernacle is there and Jesus is in the tabernacle, you genuflect when you enter, right? You genuflect. You don't stay standing, but you genuflect. So kneeling is a sign of recognizing that Jesus is the King. So again, Pope Benedict says we have to have that interior attitude of kneeling. And we ask ourselves, what will help me most to kneel before the majesty of Jesus Christ? Is the best way for me to kneel in my heart before the divine majesty? Is the best way for me to do that to stand? Then I should stand. If, like most Catholics throughout the history of the Church, the best way for me to kneel behind the divine majesty in my heart is for me to actually kneel with my body, then the kneeler is here, and you're welcome to make use of it. Okay? But either is fine. It's really all about the heart. It's all about the heart. And just think of it. Just think of it as a last point. Jesus really is the King of the universe. He really is King. Now, on earth, if we want to visit a king or a famous person, we have to travel a long distance, right? We have to go a long ways We have to spend a lot. It's major sacrifice. We go a long ways to get to him. We wait and we wait and we wait to see him. We spend a lot of our own money and energy and resources and time. And then what? We maybe get one or two words and he passes us on, right? And people do this though. All this energy, all this time, all this money spent just for one or two words, and then the king or the famous person goes on. But with Jesus, who's the king of the universe, with Jesus, it's the opposite. He comes to us, right? We don't have to go to him. He comes to us here in the sacrament. He spends everything for you and for me. He gave everything just to be with you and to be with me, even his own life. And we don't have to wait for him. He waits for us. Here he is in this tabernacle and in the monstrance at our adoration chapel, day and night, night and day. He's waiting for you because he loves you. He loves you so much. He longs for you to come and receive him into your heart. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.